With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Institute. It's a beautiful sunny evening, but as I'm sure you'll all agree, we're in some beautiful surroundings in here. You will no doubt have all heard about Formula Students as they constantly bring on young, innovative engineers who all work to an amazingly open set of regulations every year. You know, we question whether Formula One needs these new rules, but to give you a little sort of glimpse into Formula Student, this year 50 teams entered with an electric powertrain, and that number 5 years ago was just four, so there's a huge change there. Do please give Formula Student a follow on social media. On Twitter, they're at Formula Student. And then if on Facebook, if you search for IMECI Formula Student. You can actually ask questions through those social media channels this evening. So do log on now. I know you've just been asked to put your phones to silent, but I'm sure you can quickly do that. On our panel this evening, we have Pat Simmons, the Chief Technical Officer at Williams Formula One. Andy Cowell, the Managing Director at Mercedes-Benz High Performance Powertrains, Kirsty Andrew, the Sales Director at Cosworth, and our very own Motorsport Magazine's Grand Prix Editor, Mark Hughes. I'm sure you all agree that we have a fantastic lineup of people who can tell us from the inside the Formula One paddock what these new rules mean. As I alluded to, we've got a camera over there, and we are actually streaming live to the internet as I speak. So please, when you're speaking, try not to swear too much. And when we have our Q&As at the end, do please make sure you've got a microphone before you ask the question. We'll all hear you in this room, but the people on the internet all over the world won't. Don't worry, we will have someone walking around with a microphone. So just put up your hand and we'll get it to you. So the Formula One rules, and are they working? Are they good for the fans? Are they good for the teams, and are they good for the sport in general? We've just been through one of the biggest changes in Formula One in a generation. And now we've gone from 2.4 litre V8s to 1.6 litre turbo V6s with a huge emphasis on energy recovery systems. Not only that, but the fuel that each car can use has gone from roughly 160 kilograms to just 100. The fact that the cars are actually already pretty much matching the lap times from last year is absolutely amazing. Many people have questioned why we needed these regulations, especially when so many teams on the Formula One grid are struggling financially. They've been hugely expensive. And there have been critics of them. Some you will have heard of, Bernie Eccleston, Ferrari's chairman, Luca di Montezemolo, and actually many of the fans. Anyway, you're not here to listen to me speak, so could you please put together your hands for our panel and we'll get started. Mark, we'll start with you. You're sat right next to me. You've been to all the races this year, and obviously for the magazine, you write about your trackside view. You've seen these cars up close. Let's talk about the sound. Lots of people have been talking about it. Is it really that bad?
I personally don't think it is that bad. It's a lot quieter, much quieter. But the quality of the sound, I think, is better. Before it was just a blanket of noise, and now you can actually hear the various phases, the different phases of the corner. So in braking and in harvesting and in acceleration and path throttle and cylinder cut and all those things, you can actually make them out much more clearly. So you can hear what's going on better. I think the tone of them is great. But it's not really coming across on TV. And I think probably we need to look at how the mics are being set up. And I think they had a lot of baffling on them in the previous era. And I think in a lot of cases they're still using the microphones from there. So I think it's more a case of getting that quality of sound across on the TV. And I think probably most of the critics have only heard them on TV.
There's been a few comments on the Motorsport website who say, well, you're a journalist, you're a, you know, very privileged group who gets get much closer to the action, you're standing trackside. Is that a fair view if you're sat in the grandstands, which nowadays are getting further and further away from the track?
At some of the big the big Tilkadrums, yeah, that's probably a valid point. You are an awful long way away, and they are massively quieter. Somewhere like Montreal, it's just bouncing off the walls and off the trees. They sounded fantastic there, and I'm pretty sure it was loud enough for anyone to pick out, you know, the quality and the tone of the engines there. Just depends on the venue.
Andy, just quickly coming to you. Recently, Mercedes trialled a trumpet exhaust to try and sort of artificially make it a little bit noisier. What was your opinion on that? Is that artificial, or is that something that we need to do for the fans?
That was something we did in response to the comments in those opening races. I don't think any of us want to tear up the power unit, and so it was a case of what can we do without disturbing the turbocharger, and then just a quick experiment just with a tailpipe change.
Being an engineer, are you of the view that the noisier a car is, the more wasted energy there is?
There's not a huge amount of energy in the noise. The vast majority of the energy in the exhaust pipe is in the mass flow and the temperature of the gases coming out. But it's something that the fans have asked for Formula One to have a look at what can be done. We tried something as quickly as we could at the first available test. It worked reasonably well in the dyno. It didn't work well on the track. There are some more tests being done by other teams at the Silverstone test.
And you just mentioned there that obviously there was a reaction of the fans, and you were asked to trial something. There's been a huge reaction from the fans about the double points at the end of the season. How come something like that can't be looked at or changed? Just explain to everyone why that's so much harder to change once it's been decided.
That's probably one for Pat. Pat's an expert.
Passing the buck. Pat, do you want to take that up?
Do you mean the double points? I find it a little bit contrived, but I'm as likely to benefit from it as to lose from it. So I'll give you a honest answer straight after Abu Dhabi. the thing with the rules is, as long as the rules are the same for everyone, that's what you deal with. Personally, I would rather every race had the same value, but if it's double points, so be it.
Andy, something I was going to come on and talk about is just off the back of the Austrian Grand Prix, another Mercedes 1-2, so congratulations on that.
3-4.
So we'll come to you in a second, Pat.
6-7.
It was a race of saving brakes, saving energy recovery systems, saving tyres, monitoring all these things. To some people, Formula One is the pinnacle, despite going flat out for the race distance. Is this what Formula One should be? Should it be about monitoring and conserving every part of the car?
The challenge through autumn and winter, as you're laying out a car and laying out the size of the systems, is to come up with something that makes a fast car, but isn't necessarily managing the overheads for every single circuit. And so you go to some circuits where brakes are a challenge, you go to some circuits where fuel's a challenge, etc. Austria was tough on fuel for some teams. Depending on the aerodynamic characteristics of the car. It was tough on front brakes for some teams and not for others. It was an event where we were very mindful of the temperatures within our earth system, following the experience that and learning experience that we'd had in Canada, and that's often the case. You know, you have a problem, you have a failure, and you react with some containment to manage the duty cycle and when you use it and when you don't.
Would it be safe to say that as we go into next year, everyone's had a year under their belt with these new regulations, with the new cars, that a lot of those systems are going to become less critical and you're going to be monitoring them less? Or by the very nature of Formula One, because you're pushing things to the limit, you're still going to be doing that?
I think it'd be a bit of both. I think all three of the manufacturers, power unit manufacturers for this year, will have learnt a lot from going to 19 races, but there are also some new technologies that are permitted for next year. So we're allowed variable inlet systems for next year. You know, there's the development of that, and there'll be the learning process. We try and leave the development in the factory for as long as possible, freeze it as late as possible, do the prove out, and go racing. As with any technology, the prove out doesn't always go to plan, but in racing you don't leave any contingency because you want the development phase to be as long as possible, and that's why sometimes you get caught out and you react by managing the on-track performance and recovering as quickly as you can.
Pat, third and fourth in Austria. We were talking to you before that you're actually back at base for this race, and you said actually you can do so much and you can keep abreast of everything that's coming up. How much more complicated from a team's perspective and an engineer's perspective has a race become this year compared to last year? We hear a lot more over the radio, and we get a sort of a glimpse of how much more there's to think about, or is that not true?
Yeah, I think on the pit wall, or the virtual pit wall, there is an awful lot more to do. The V8s were relatively simple to manage. We had our different engine modes. We had to manage our fuel because, you know, although everyone says it's a fuel-limited formula now, as far as I'm concerned, it's always been a fuel-limited formula. We never put in more fuel than we need. We've had to do tyre management in previous years. So really, things haven't changed much other than the fact we have a lot more modes that we can run our power unit in. So we have to choose those modes quite carefully to get optimum performance, to keep within our operating limits. A reasonable amount of it is, let's call it, semi-automatic. But still, yeah, there's a much higher workload on the pit wall.
Kirsty, we were talking earlier about the work that Cosworth's doing on the electronics in Formula One. I was going to come onto this a bit later, but just to try and give everyone an idea of how, you know, Cosworth works on so many different forms of motorsport, whether it's Le Mans, IndyCar, where does Formula One sit with these new regulations? I mean, how advanced is it? Is it comparable to any other championship out there, or is it just way beyond any of them?
I think it is definitely the one that you need to invest the most amount of money in to be successful in, and maybe Andy can talk about that a little bit later. But in terms of the whole package on the car, not just the powertrain, but the electronics, the sensors, the steering wheel, any part of it is very much more complex than any other series. Although we do see with the ACO's regulations and with WEC that the regulations, obviously, because they have a similar but different, you know, an energy recovery formula now as well for the LMP1 cars, and we see that the electronics required in that is obviously as sophisticated, and obviously we're very involved in that as a series, not just in terms of scrutineering but in terms of supply to different teams.
Mark, do we need this complexity in Formula One?
I think it's part and parcel of the new formula, and I think we needed the new formula longer term. As Pat says, is a huge increase in the number of engine modes, and it's sort of misleading to say that you're controlling them in a sense of you're limiting performance. You're not. I mean, in the old days, you would have to run the engine in its most conservative mode all the way through in order to get it to the end. And now there's the possibility to have short periods of higher power, and it's more that. So yeah, in terms of control of the power units, yeah, I think it's part and parcel, and it's just, you know, evolution. But the drivers are still, as long as the tires are durable, the drivers are still able to drive on flat out. It's just they've got a different setting on the steering wheel, but they're still able to drive them flat out. What I didn't like, what I used to object to, was when we had sort of artificially poor tyres that you had to deliberately drive 2-3 seconds off the pace in the early stages when you were heavily fueled in order to get a competitive stint time. I didn't feel that was Formula One. I felt that was more what used to be endurance racing, which ironically enough, which, you know, the top teams all on Michelins go flat out from start to finish, and it seems that got that the wrong way around. So, but no, in terms of having control on power units and monitoring that, no, I personally don't have a problem with that.
Andy, we mentioned it just then, that the money, you know, these new regulations have cost a huge amount for every team, whether they are an engine supplier or they're not, or they're buying the engines. Was there a way to keep, you know, to update the rules, but for a smaller amount financially? I mean, it seems that this has cost such a huge amount at a time when so many teams are struggling.
If I think back to some of the changes that we've done in the past, then I don't think it's a huge amount of money. If I think back to the era where every year we were doing a new high revving naturally aspirated engine, and the development period that we had, we were spending considerably more money than we do today. And if I look at the development costs for the V6 and the ER system, and compare that with the last the V8 that we did when we introduced that, and add KERS in, then this hasn't been more expensive.
But from an independent team's perspective, what are your views on that, on the cost?
Yeah, the cost hurts. There's no doubt about it. But you know, you've got to put these things in perspective. You've got to think about where they started, you've got to think about where they're going, and you've got to think about the path along the way. So if we go back to where they started, this was an initiative to have a more modern engine, which was decided in the days when all the talk was of CO2. Recession was something that happened a decade ago, and you know, we weren't interested in it anymore. But there's quite a long gestation period for any change that's as radical as this. And by the time it came through, I won't say that CO2 was less important, but I guess if I was cynical and I said that energy independence was perhaps not the subject it had been a few years ago when we were fighting in the Middle East, etc. That's a very cynical view. And of course, recession had impacted motorsport quite severely. We got these new power units at one could say the wrong time, but one has to take a longer term view of this. This is the right thing to do. You know, these power units are very similar to the power units that are going to be in road cars. In some ways, of course, already are. And it is a fact that the power units in your road cars are going to cost more. You know, you can remember old-fashioned, very simple power units with carburetors and push rods and things like that. Of course, they were cheaper to produce than even a modern, normally aspirated engine. And the next generation, or the current to next generation of road car engines, which are going to be downsized, turbocharged, highly hybridized engines, are going to cost more. But in the long run, that's what we need to do for society.
Kirsten, your old job, you worked in the commercialization of Formula One technology into the automotive sector at Williams Advanced Engineering. How much crossover is there from Formula One to the automotive sector? You know, we hear so many stories from various people saying, oh, well, this steering wheel's from, you know, from Formula One. I won't mention any names, but probably Ferrari. Tell us a bit about how much actually is fed down into an everyday car.
I think sort of picking up on Pat's point, now that the engine regulations are as they are, it is very much more obvious. I think it's a pity, and it's something I said before, that we haven't called it the hybridisation of a Formula One car rather than calling it ERS, because it would be something that the general public would actually understand a little more. They could see the relevance. I think it's technology that's not only necessarily just for automotive, but for other motive applications. And we may not have the same pressure or the same focus on CO2, but we do need to certainly recognise that there is a finite fossil fuel resource, and this is a way of taking it out longer. But in terms of some of the electronics, obviously, if the power management systems that are on an F1 car, you're not going to take that straight away and put it on a road car, even a supercar. But the principle is the same, because you are combining different sources of energy to create motive power. So it's those sort of things. And the beauty of motorsport, and particularly Formula One, is that the development cycle is so short. You're seeing something, and I think we spoke about it earlier, if you look at how few cars had trouble-free running in the pre-season testing, to see how many cars finished the first Grand Prix, nobody would have made that connection between what they saw in pre-season testing to how well the cars actually ran in the first race, and have continued to do so through the season, with some exceptions, clearly. And that kind of rapid development and problem-solving is actually one of the things that the industry can take into the automotive industry, and also the carbon fibre technology. But again, it's not completely applicable in the way a Formula One car is built to how you would build an ordinary road car.
Pat, just coming back to you for a second, should Formula One be relevant, or should it be a standalone championship that's exciting, that brings in millions of fans across the world?
It should be relevant. I think that Formula One is in quite a difficult situation. It's a sort of, I don't know whether there is such a word, it's a sort of trichotomy that it's in. It doesn't know whether it's a business, a sport, or a technical exercise, and we have to sort of balance that. But I do think it should be relevant, and I think, you know, the power units at the moment are a very good example of that. And while I might be slightly cynical about the CO2 side of things and how politicians seem to change their minds from day to day, one thing we do know is that fuel is expensive. I noticed yesterday we're up over $60 a barrel again, and you know that hits us. We are going to, all of us, as we drive our road cars, the fuel gets more and more expensive, and that matters to us. You know, we can't afford to drive cars that do 20 miles to the gallon anymore, so it is relevant. As a sport, it's quite difficult. You know, we have to have that side of it. We have to balance our engineering into being relevant, but ultimately we have to provide entertainment. You know, that's where our income comes from. It comes from entertaining people. So we're a sport, we're an entertainment, we're a business, we're a technical exercise. It's a very difficult balance to keep correct.
Andy, I saw you nodding there. I take it you agree.
Yeah, just the last couple of questions then. You know, the reason for changing was to get a set of regulations where the R&D facilities for any of the manufacturers that want to come in, or independents that want to come into Formula One, are chasing conversion efficiency. So it's all about a fixed amount of fuel and how much useful energy can you get out of that and use it in a racing environment, using it in a real environment, not a laboratory environment. And that's where motorsport is brilliant at accelerating technology from the laboratory to the real environment. And it's a very harsh, you know, very, you know, Sunday afternoon, your name's plastered all over the world if you've done a bad job or a brilliant job. And so it's very important for the manufacturers that the regulations changed to match the emissions of the road car world. And CO2 emissions per kilometre, there are regulations that are there. Regardless of the political situations around the world that Pat's referring to, those regulations are coming in year by year and getting tougher and tougher. Here in Europe and all around the world, in China, in India, all those countries as well. So it's really important that we try and link the two together and encourage motor manufacturers into Formula One. And we're seeing that with Honda coming in next year.
Can you, if you're a big car manufacturer, if you come into Formula One, the money that you're going to spend on R&D as a road car manufacturer, can you offset any of that with the Formula One budget? We heard from Kirsty that while you can't take a part of a Formula One car and put it in a road car, if you're the boss of this company, can you change that budget and say, well, while we're spending this in Formula One, we're actually taking it out of R&D because it's so much better?
10 years ago, I would say manufacturers are in to have a fast, glamorous advertising hoarding going around the circuit. These days, with the technology that we've just introduced, we saw it a bit with Kurs, to introduce a small hybrid aspect. Now with what we've got with the V6 and ERS, they are incredible bits of equipment. The thermal efficiency from the internal combustion engine is amazing. The power and energy density from the ERS system is amazing, and that is going to be transferred into road car. And with all these new technologies, they start with the supercars. You know, if you look at Porsche with the 918, Ferrari with LaFerrari, it starts in that arena, and then it filters down. And I think that's the great thing about the regulations that we've got today, that Mercedes see the work that we're doing at Brixworth as advanced R&D that will filter down into the road car world. And we're already starting to do work for AMG, high performance engines for the future.
And I think one of the indicators that you would see is that traditionally the Formula One efforts of OEMs came out of marketing budgets, and now they come out of R&D budgets. And that is a reflection of the fact that the engineering that's taking place is one that has a crossover potential, not always directly, but that it's pushing the boundaries. I think even if you look at WEC as well, that someone like Porsche and Audi are very clear that the reason they go racing is to prove technology that they will put in road cars.
Mark, wasn't it Bernie Eccleston who said that he didn't care about the manufacturers in Formula One because they never stayed around for very long? I mean, I take it this changes things a bit if they are coming at it from a different angle.
Yeah, I mean, they're in it, as Andy was saying, probably their motivations slightly different now, but no, it remains a valid point that you can't get too reliant on people that are just using the sport, it's not their only business. I think you still have to encompass the direction that technology is going in. So, I think the road car manufacturers should be welcomed in. You shouldn't. I think it's good that you attract as many in as possible, so the impact of any one of them leaving is less. But I think had we just kept what we had, we'd probably lost Renault and may have lost Mercedes. I don't know, Andy, you'll probably have a better idea on that. We'd probably have Cosworth and Ferrari supplying the whole field. With technology that was very mature and hardly any difference, and now we have great differences between the power plant. Technically, it's much more interesting.
And am I right that you can actually hear the difference between the cars on the track? You've alluded to
in the Grand Prix report. You couldn't before. I think the last time I could hear the difference in the normally aspirated engines was in the V10 era. The Honda sounded different, but all the rest sound the same. In the V8 era, defy anyone to be able to pick out which engine was which. But in these ones, you can stand 10 minutes at the side of the track and you can definitely pick out which engines are which.
Andy, would you agree with Mark's statement there about the only manufacturers left in Formula One on the engine side?
I think we would have ended up with a standard engine. And for the pinnacle of motorsport, to have a standard engine would have been criminal. It's motorsport.
Mark, just staying with you for a second, for the website you write extremely detailed Grand Prix reports, and they've obviously gone out very well, but the average fan, can they understand everything that's going on behind the scenes? Because there's so much now, and the TV viewing figures are going down. We asked whether the new Formula One rules are a success. Surely that's one of the biggest barometers that you set your opinion by.
Yeah, I think with regard to TV figures, two key markets have just gone pay to view this year. I think that's the main driver of that start. I think generally all sports are seeing a decline because there's so much more competition in for people's times in all areas. I think that's just the state of the modern world. That's the way it's going. I don't think it's particularly related to any particular problem that Formula One has, although there's always room for improvement. In terms of the getting the appeal of F1 across to the fans, I think power units will rapidly become a non-issue. I don't think that's where any of the problems lie.
Well, I suppose, sorry, Kirsty.
I was just going to say, I don't think actually it's the size of the audience that should be the primary concern as much as the demographic, because it is aging. And I think that's, I know it's a subject that's talked about a lot, but there are different ways that people enjoy entertainment other than just watching it on the television. And I think that there's something that does need to be looked at. I think what will be interesting is something like Formula E, which is taking a very different approach to its engagement with fans. You know, you can tweet and they're going to get a push to pass opportunity or something for whoever gets the most. I don't know how they're going to make that work in practice, but that will be, you know, I think it will be interesting to see what level engagement that does get. You know, it's an experiment, isn't it?
Pat, what are your thoughts on this? How are the, in your opinion, sort of how can you make this sort of, I don't know, digestible, I think is the right word, for the average fan who turns on maybe one every two Grand Prix?
It's an interesting question, I think. Do you need to understand the offside rule to enjoy a game of football? I'm not sure you do.
You're speaking to the wrong person here, I'm afraid.
I think I'm speaking to the wrong country, actually. But I think as engineers, we love our cars. We think we're racing cars, but most of the fans are actually following the drivers. We have to remember that. But I think one of the great things about Formula One is you can take it at whatever level you wish to take it. So if you are a casual viewer who follows Lewis Hamilton or Nico Rosberg or whatever, you can do it at that level. But equally, if you want to get involved technically, you can enjoy the technicalities at whatever level you choose to enjoy them at. And, you know, for an audience like this at the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, I'm sure that they want to know to some depth what the technical aspects are. But equally, there are many who don't. So it's a great sport in that you can take it in whatever level you wish.
Andy, I'm probably going to, I'm asking this question to the wrong person, I think, but over the last few years, the focus has been on aerodynamics. And, you know, to some people, that's quite a hard sell. Would you say that powertrains and the technology and the powertrains is an easier sell to people?
Probably yes. I think, you know, the aerodynamics on the car, what connection is there with that and the road car that you drive? Maybe if you've glued a spoiler on the back of your car that you bought from Halfords, yes. But you know, to try and look like a racing car, but there's no direct connection. Having direct injected, heavily turbocharged engines with a hybrid system in there that is providing performance, and so you can indicate to the world that hybrid's cool. Yeah, hybrid isn't geography teacher. Yeah, hybrid is Lewis Hamilton fast winning a Grand Prix.
God, I've got to stand up for the chassis engineers now. a few years ago, I was actually doing some work for a very large OEM on aerodynamics of road cars, and it was a very interesting bit of work that I was doing. And the reason they engaged me to do that work was they wanted to understand how Formula One applied aerodynamics and how that could be translated into the road car industry. And it's very interesting, I think, that when a lot of people, when they look at, they ask the question, what are we transferring from motorsport into road cars, and they're looking for components. And often it's not components. You know, you can go back to your, whenever it was, disc brakes on a Jaguar and you know, the history like that. But these days it's much more about technique. And one of the things I was able to do on that project was to show the techniques that we use in wind tunnel testing and CFD. And we took, I'm afraid I can't say who the manufacturer was, but we took one of their cars which had a drag coefficient of 0.24, which is a pretty damn good drag coefficient. We got it down to 0.22 just by applying some very simple techniques. And we had a target to get it down to 0.20, which was achievable by using some of the tricks that we'd learnt in Formula One, but certainly some of the techniques. And I think the same is true, you know, even on the powertrain side, that yes, you won't necessarily take that component from a racing engine and that's what you'll see on a road engine, but a lot of the technology that Andy is developing is technology that Mercedes are just sucking up to put into road cars.
I'd just like to say I'm generally in favour of the slight shift in emphasis from aero to power plants, and one of the big changes made, which is often overlooked in this year's regs, is it's a big reduction in downforce from a set of regs that Patel developed, and they are standing trackside watching the cars, they are vastly better to watch than the V8 generation of cars was. There, you can see the drivers working. There are bits of track that were just bent bits of straight before. The cars are now struggling through it. There's the kink after the hairpin in Montreal, where Vettel got sideways during the race. It's just unthinkable that would ever happened in the past, in the dry anyway. And I think we should be going further. What would be interesting is how that would tie in with you'd be, if you went further in losing downforce, you'd also be going further in losing drag, and you'd be able to limit the fuel even further. So it'd be a good headline to shout about. And I think that's definitely a direction we should be looking at going in.
And is there a bigger discrepancy between the drivers now? Is it easy to see the great drivers versus the good?
I wouldn't say so, no. It's more that they're all visibly working, whereas before it was the car that was visibly working than the driver sitting in it. Now you can see the inputs the drivers are making.
Pat, we were talking about this earlier. You know, a new set of regulations come up, and then for the next few years, all the teams play catch up. Are we going to lose this excitement when you're watching trackside as the aerodynamicists find that downforce that they lost? I mean, are they going to gain as much back?
Not in the way they used to. It's a fact that if you close down the design space, then of course it becomes more difficult to find performance. But you've got to remember that, you know, we've been very focused on powertrain when we've been talking about new regulations, but there are a lot of other new regulations that have come in as well. You know, Mark mentioned the reduction in aerodynamic downforce, but perhaps more importantly is within the sporting regulations, we have a reduction in the amount of aerodynamic research that we can do. And I think at the World Council meeting tomorrow, there'll be announced a further reduction where we come down to 65 wind tunnel runs from our current 80 a week. And that's going to make it significantly more difficult to catch up in the way we used to. And we started a new regime of aerodynamic testing that we call 30-30, which balances sort of 30 hours of wind on time and 30 teraflops of CFD usage. We've been running that since mid-January, so now we've got a pretty good idea of what that has done to our rate of development compared to previous years, and it's hit it. You know, it really has. The week-on-week points of downforce that we're looking for have reduced significantly. We're making a further reduction. It will take time to catch up to where we are. And I agree with Mark. You know, I like to see cars moving around.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I love watching rally cars, actually, because, you know, you can see the guys working so hard and so little grip and things. And, of course, there's no reason why we can't cut downforce further. It's a relatively simple and it's certainly a low-cost thing to do. And now we've, at source, we've attacked the cost of the aerodynamic research, which, of course, spills all the way through, you know, the number of people you've got designing your car, the number of updates you're bringing to your car. It's a pretty good thing, and it will take a long while to get back to the levels of downforce that we enjoyed last year.
Andy and Kirsty, we've just heard, you know, two people here who are before taking away even more downforce from the cars. Are you of the same opinion, and what's stopping Formula One, you know, making these changes? Will it be an easy change?
I'd encourage the removal of more downforce. I think it has made the cars a lot more exciting to watch, and it makes the power unit more important.
And I would echo that. I think the other thing to recognise in terms of the power unit is how light they are, and that's one of the things that certainly an OEM is attracted to in the sort of work, whether it's directly for a team or for an independent company like ours, is that actually clearly if you want to make a lightweight power unit, you start with that as a design objective, but it still allows you to take a heavier unit and make it considerably lighter, like we did with Aston Martin, took over 20% of the weight out of the engine. But it's that sort of design principle. And also the other thing that is particularly attractive, and when we're talking about technology transfer, is that when you're involved in motorsport, in Formula One, you design, manufacture and operate your product. Most other industry sectors don't do all three elements. And actually, in Formula One itself, the bit that the independent teams don't do is design, operate and manufacture their engine. That's done independently. So that's where someone like Mercedes has gained the benefit, because it's in charge of its whole destiny all together, if you like. But that is a really unique perspective for Formula One: design, manufacture and operate.
And, you know, obviously we know why losing weight from an engine and something like an Aston Martin is very important, any road car. But Formula One, even though they're allowed fewer engines this year, surely it's a different type of approach, because while Aston Martin is going for performance, they're also going for longevity as well. Is there still a link there with Formula One? Because I know there's obviously reliability is very important, but it's a racing car for a set number of races and then that's it.
And that's just about deciding what the duty cycle you want the engine to survive. So again, it's back to the design parameters you start at the beginning. So the amount of weight you might have taken out of a V12 to put it in a racing car is going to be different to putting it into a road car, even if it is a supercar. So it just is about the design parameters and setting what your duty cycle is. What is it? How many kilometres do you want to do before you have to service it or rebuild? And obviously that depends on your competitive environment. And I guess in Formula One, people would rather they weren't having to do it as often as it may come to at the end of the season, if we've seen some of the reliability issues. It'll be interesting to see how many engines people actually do use by the end of the season. That will be one of the challenges.
And are you worried about that, or you're all okay on your engine count?
It's a bit like the answer Pat gave, I'll tell you in Abu Dhabi after the race.
Just go back to the drivers for a second. Pat, the cars are obviously harder to drive, but do the drivers now need to be sort of engineers? I mean, you know, but they are obviously more technical, and it's a much bigger challenge for the driver because there's so much more going on, surely.
Yeah, interesting, you know, about whether they're more difficult to drive or not. I think we certainly see the cars moving around a lot more. But I think one of the very interesting things about this year is, yeah, we've got a hell of a lot more torque available. And prior to running the cars last winter, I was thinking, wow, you know, we've got a lot to deal with here. But in reality, it was an object reminder. In it's not the sort of sheer amount of torque that you've got, but it's how it's delivered. And I'm treading into Andy's territory here, who knows a lot more about this than I do. But with normally aspirated engines, we were spending a lot of time working with inlet and exhaust geometries to try and smooth what was a pretty poor torque curve, a very lumpy torque curve. And one of the things we got now is, yeah, we've got a lot of torque, but we've got great delivery of that torque. And I think if we had the sheer amount of torque that we've got now, but we had a curve like the normally aspirated, boy, then you'd see some skill involved. So to answer your question, do the drivers need to be engineers? No, they don't. You know, what I want from a driver is the ability to drive a car goes without saying. But what I want is, I don't want him doing a mathematical analysis of what's going on. I want him to give me an honest answer about how easy it is to achieve the mission that we've given him, which is to drive fast. And if it's difficult, what is it that's making it difficult? And interestingly, a few months ago, I was actually over at Airbus, and I was talking to their chief test pilot, who, as some of you may know, has the name of Fernando Alonso. And we were talking about the similarities between what he needs from his test pilots and what we want from racing drivers in terms of developing the car. And they're very, very similar. He expects his pilots to be able to fly a plane to a very high quality. I expect drivers to be able to drive a car fast. You know, that goes without saying. It's then the added value that they give, which is not necessarily being an engineer. They don't have to solve differential equations to make their car go faster. They need to understand what's going on, and they need to be able to describe it concisely and accurately.
Andy, how have you found the feedback from Nico and Lewis? They seem to have two slightly different approaches. As Pat was saying there, what you want is, you know, them to go as fast as possible, but surely they're giving you a lot more feedback than that.
Both Lewis and Nico have been heavily involved in the way we've developed the power unit, and especially the control systems. There isn't a KERS button anymore. The torque delivery is just on the right pedal, the go faster pedal, and actually the torque delivery to target is easier with these engines, because we've got a huge compressor, and people normally talk about turbo lag, but we've got a big electric machine connected to that compressor, so the speed control of the compressor is perfect, because we've got a electric machine to control it. And the fuel delivery is perfect, because we've got direct injection. So the torque delivery to target, the drivability, as the driver would refer to it, is better on these turbocharged hybrid power units than it was on the naturally aspirated V8s, which I think surprised everybody, and was one of the first bits of feedback we got from all eight of the Mercedes power unit drivers, that wow, that's a lot of torque. But actually the consistency of delivery, which I think is important for a driver, you know, there's as Pat said, it's about a driver feeding back to us what can we do to help them to make it easier to stay right on the edge. And torque delivery to target, doing absolutely the same every single lap, is a key thing for the power unit, and it's easier.
We'll come on to some questions from the floor in a second, so if you do think of some. But quickly, we've all been sort of, I think, talking about how the new Formula One regulations are actually very good. So I think it's probably an ideal time, Mark, to remind you of your Formula One Revolution piece from the April issue of the magazine. I'm sure most of you have read it, but could you just let everyone know sort of what you were talking about and why Formula One needs this change?
Yeah, in many ways it was an idealised vision, but I made the point that that shouldn't mean we don't strive for what we think is ideal. Probably not all of it immediately achievable, but it was based around the current formula, the current technical formula. But I was talking about trying to reduce downforce further. I was talking about trying to impose serious cost controls, which would then allow the technical regulations to be freer. And I was talking about less control from the teams of the drivers, so that the personalities of the drivers comes through more. And that's something that latter point is something that's seemed to strike a chord with a lot of readers. And I suggested, you know, what, for instance, what about pits to driver communication at all, so they've got to work out their own fuel settings and you know, power. So, you know, maybe have something where, you know, the only thing that would be allowed would be safety related ones, and it was just as a combination of looking at each of the areas and looking long term where Formula One would ideally be trying to head.
Andy, I saw you nodding there with the pits to driver communication. Do you agree, disagree with that?
Unfortunately, that happens some races in any case. So I was nodding, reminiscing about the odd race this year where we've lost the radio and we've lost telemetry. And we end up with engineers looking at the TV feed, the in-car TV feed, looking at the dash display, working out how the driver's getting on with fuel.
Pat, would you agree with what Mark's saying here about the sort of the cost controls? I should take that one first.
Cost controls and motive subject, isn't it? I guess if I can get my hobby horse a little bit, I think that we're talking about new rules, and I think one of the things that we haven't done particularly well is to control costs in Formula One. The step between Formula One and most other forms of racing financially is a quantum step, and I think that's something we need to address. I think we've done a spectacularly poor job of it recently, and there are far too many people grinding their own axes to ever get the unanimous support that these things need. So I certainly feel that we've probably gone a bit too far. And we need to start reining in costs. It's not a sustainable business at the moment. We need to do something about it, and we're not doing it. In terms of other suggestions, I think that it's interesting what Mark says, but I still regard motor racing as a team sport, and I like to see everyone in the team contributing. You know, we did a 2.1 second pit stop in Austria. Now that gives the guys a buzz. They really feel that they contributed to our result. And why shouldn't they? And why shouldn't the engineers contribute to it? You know, it's not all about driver and machine. It's a team sport. So I'm reasonably happy with the way things are. There are certainly times when I'd like to turn the radio off, though.
Andy, would you agree that we need to cut costs, and that should be the forefront of discussions?
It's important that we keep it sustainable, and it's important that we've got a good number of cars on the grid, and enough teams. There's no point having one team providing 22 cars. You know, I think this is a topic that's been worked on for many years, and we've not yet got to a good solution. We have made some very good steps though over the years. You know, I spoke earlier about sort of 10 years ago, the cost of a Formula One naturally aspirated engine 10 years ago was more than it is today for a V6 turbocharged, direct injected, you know, two electric machines and a big battery. And that's been done because the engine manufacturers have taken on board the aspect of how many power units is the production run. The intention for these rules was that it would be 4 power units per driver per championship, and that's what we've got for next year. We all agreed in a regulation meeting that it might be a bit tough in the first year, and therefore we should have 5 in the first year, which is why the number is 5 this year. And that does pull down the production costs, and you've got to make the rules severe, that if you take the 6th one, it's a big grid penalty. And that has, you know, driven the engine manufacturers to go from 50-kilometre qualifying engines, you know, that you fitted new pistons just before they went out the door, and you were sending 12 engines to each garage, and you'd use them all through a race weekend. You know, the costs were crazy, the production costs were crazy just 10 years ago. And tightening down on that has reduced the costs for a propulsion unit. I think we probably need to do more in some of the other areas.
But I think it's interesting what Andy brings up here, because you know, we're talking about regulation changes. We're talking mainly about technical regulations, and of course with our Formula Student connection, with our Institution of Mechanical Engineers connection, of course we'll be talking about engineering changes. But history has shown over the last few years that actually the cost saving has come from changes to the sporting regulations rather than technical regulations. So long life engines, things like that, are not actually technical regulations, they're sporting ones, the reduction in testing, all these sort of things. So you can't blame everything on the engineers, that's for sure.
Right, I think this is a good opportunity to open up the floor to some questions. Do just raise your hand and Robert will come and find you with a microphone. I think we've also might have some questions from the webinar, if Fiona's got any of those, and also from social media. But do please ask away. It's a great opportunity to speak to some of the greatest minds in the sport.
This is Andrew Bodman. I've got a question for the full panel, really, and it's a rather idealistic question. Perhaps you can treat it as idealistic in your answer as well. There are rumours that there are 3 or 4 Formula One teams that are having a certain amount of financial difficulty at the moment, and therefore, if you like, that's partly due to the inequitable distribution of money at the end of the year. So my idealistic suggestions are all the money that currently goes to CVC / Bernie Eccleston is ploughed back into the primarily the teams and a little bit into the actual race promoters like Silverstone and the other circuit providers. That's one thing, you plough it back into the sport, into the teams. And the other thing is, rather than it being based on finishing position and points, you give every team the same amount of money at the end of the year.
But how does that reward success? Why is that inequitable?
Because the small teams like Marussia and Caterham are struggling financially. And one of the reasons they struggle financially is because they get so little income at the end of the year. If you want to have 11 teams running successfully year after year after year sustainably, then they need to have a better share of money. And the small teams can't survive easily on the small amount of money they get.
I think that's different maybe in terms of the regulation. There needs to maybe be some balance and capping. But I, having been involved in motorsport for a long time, I sort of don't get the concept of if you finish first, you don't get more reward than anybody else.
You talked about an idealised world. I think in an idealised world, the sport would be owned by the participants. And the teams would have a franchise in the sport, and I agree that I don't like the principle of mediocrity not being punished, and I think you should get more for winning than not, but I think it should be a business model where each of the teams has a sustainable long-term business, and I think the income that F1 generates, there's no reason why it couldn't be.
But the more successful teams are likely to get better sponsorship rewards.
Yes, I think the current income distribution is inequitous, yes.
I think it's an interesting suggestion, and it's not a new one, and believe it or not, Bernie has offered to the teams quite recently that all the income is split evenly. It was not accepted by the teams. Maybe by some of them. But I think, you know, even earlier on, I probably fell into the same trap myself. We do keep talking about cost saving. and we're not talking enough about income generation. So as far as the teams are concerned, yes, it'd be very nice to have a larger share of the pot. But for a global sport, that pot is not very big. And that's another area we should be looking at. You know, you look at what the Premier League is pulling in as an income, and how successful it is for, you know, even the lower teams, the parachute payments they can have, etc., etc. Well, for a global sport, we're not doing particularly good on generating income.
Thank you very much for that. Is there another question from the floor?
Thank you. John Fox. I do wonder how real some of the cost savings that have been introduced through the number of engines and gearboxes restrictions, and also the testing freeze and the engine freeze actually are, because I'm a bit concerned about perhaps the unintended consequences for the sporting nature of the game. At the weekend, we saw Sebastian Vettel retire, or his car was retired to save engine mileage. I didn't think that was allowed, actually, but maybe it is now. That raises the possibility that in the future 10 cars will finish each race, or maybe 11, because they think there's a sniff of a point at the end of it. Also, the engine freeze, it seems to me, stops people catching up. It was something that you said, Pat, that the wind tunnel thing, you know, the restrictions on that will stop people catching up. Mercedes seem to have a bit of a stranglehold on the championship at the moment, and frankly, I'm worried that that won't change now, and therefore why am I watching the rest of the series? And it's been like that really for the past 4 years, I would say now, where teams seem unable to catch up. One team dominates and there isn't a swing of fortune throughout the season. So I suppose two parts of the question really is, how real are the real cost savings, and is the impact on the sporting spectacle unacceptable?
I can have a good go at that one. I think the I know from first-hand experience over the last 10 years working for Mercedes that the budget's gone down on an annual basis, and the biggest driver has been the requirement for the engine to do more, so you don't buy as many bits, because typically it's the same amount of parts that you need to do a prove out. So if you can reduce your production cost, the number for the 19 races, you're better off. Is the freeze bad for us this year? Fuel isn't frozen, oil isn't frozen, calibrations aren't frozen, and when you look at the performance steps that Renault and Ferrari have made this year, they're considerable, and that will carry on throughout the year, and the engines, the V6 ER systems, aren't frozen into the future. Every year we can do a new version. For next year there's a list of areas that we can work on, performance areas, based on making the power unit more efficient, making that conversion efficiency greater from the fuel energy to useful propulsion energy. And each year the number that you can pick from that diminishes. But in the opening year, so the transition from 14 to 15, it's quite a big list. So Ferrari and Renault have got a great opportunity to catch us up for next year. And when you look at the improvements they're making through the year, you know, we're looking over our shoulder and keeping a close eye on that this year. So I think with the way the sporting regulations, again, have been set up, you're not locked into being in the down on power brigade and getting all grumpy and asking for a dispensation for an upgrade like Renault and Honda asked for in 2008. So hopefully we do maintain healthy competition, but with some cost control, because it's only 4 power units per driver.
I'd just add to that I believe, I can't remember my numbers exactly, but I think that in 2000... at Benetton, I think our engine bill was higher than it is now. And that's in real terms, that's not inflation adjusted or anything.
And I sold the engine gears to most of these people at the time because I worked for Xtrack, and yes, it is a lot different now.
And they were very expensive.
Reassuringly expensive.
Good quality.
Have we got another question from the floor?
It was touched on briefly earlier, talking about the aerodynamics, but how do you feel about the amount of variation in the front nose cones designs on the car? Obviously, you compare something like Lotus to Ferrari to Force India, they're so different. Do you think that's an advantage, or do you think it'd be better if they were all clips, they were a bit more similar?
I'm glad someone brought up nose height, because we've sort of ignored that. And bearing in mind this is a Formula student presentation, I'd just like to tell a little story about that. The drive to low noses has been done for safety reasons. And I think one of the things we're concerned with every accident that can happen in Formula One, but we're particularly concerned with accidents where a car is launched, because at that point we can be involving people who really shouldn't be involved. Now, what I mean by that is that drivers take an acceptable risk in driving the car. We want to minimise that risk, of course we do, both actively and passively. But I think what worries us all more than anything is a flying car that we can no longer control, either involving marshals or, even worse, spectators. And the low noses that have now been introduced are the result of a program looking at what launches a car and what the propensity to launch is comparing nose heights, energy absorption, etc. And that's a program that's actually started by a student who was sponsored by Benetton back in similar sort of time, maybe late 90s or so. A student at Cranfield University by the name of Joanna Gibson. I think she's married now and changed her name. But it was a great illustration, I think, of how students can contribute. Okay, it's a long while on, but it was work that was actually started by students. That's a little aside. It didn't really answer your question, but I did want to get that in somewhere. I think it's I can't say that some of the designs are the prettiest things we've ever seen, but at least there's some variation in them. And the rules for next year have actually, I think, got rid of some of the more extreme things that we've seen this year. I say I think because who knows, you know, we try and write these rules and we don't really spend enough time seeing what the unintended consequences are, and it's not to say that someone won't come up with something quite bizarre, but we've tried to learn from this year and tried to improve them. So the rules that are going through World Council tomorrow, I think will at least make the cars look a little bit more attractive.
This one's from the webinar. With Formula Student, the technical regulations are very open. What advice would you give to the teams who are basically competing in 2 weeks to balance stretching the engineering envelope and actually meeting the deadline, which is a running car at the event? So how would you go about balancing an open rule book and getting sort of engineering innovation in that rule book to getting a completed car ready for competition?
Well, one of the things I love about Formula Student, and one of the reasons why as an employer it certainly becomes a differentiator when we're looking to recruit people, is that it is a microcosm of what we do in motorsport, and that deadline is such an important thing. You know, we can't phone up Bernie and say, oh, we're a bit behind on making our diffusers this week, you know, can you put the race off till Monday? It doesn't happen. And I think it's one of the things that the students learn, and I think I certainly remember when I was a student, it was always left to the last minute, wasn't it? Andy alluded earlier to the fact that you're trying to leave your development as late as possible because that adds performance. And I think that the Formula Student program has got a really good balance of that. Very open regulations, but that deadline that will not move. So to answer the question, how do you exploit it? You leave your development time as long as you can, but that means you've got a plan and you've got to run your program through to that event at Silverstone in a couple of weeks. You know, that's not going to change. It's very good training, and it It means that engineers have to have their feet on the ground, and they have to have an element of reality, which is very important to them as they follow their careers in later life.
It also means you need to buy into the plan as a team, not just somebody's idea of when the end date can be for design and development. You all have to be aligned with it, and then everybody has to work to make sure it happens, because the one thing you can be certain of is if you don't run, you get no points.
Are there any more questions from the floor? One there.
How do you think it would have been if the V6 and the turbo hadn't been stipulated, if the FIA just said you've got to reduce the amount of fuel you use to 100 kilos and just left it as open as that?
It would have cost an awful lot more money, which is why we... The reason why there are some defined numbers in the technical regulations are to control the development cost from regulation release to first race, so that we didn't do a whole load of research on the bore size, on the number of cylinders, on the V-angle, on the crankshaft centerline height, all of which we thought weren't great for thermal efficiency improvement. But that's not answering your question. If it had been completely free, we would have ended up with less cylinders, lower RPM, more boost, three cylinders in line, huge amount of boost, a little bit more efficiency, but a ridiculous amount of cost.
Any more questions from the floor? We can probably take one or two more. There's one right at the back there.
How do you decide? I would assume that the performances are not identical in all the engines that you supply to the teams. So how do you decide what engines to give to Williams and the ones you keep?
How should I answer that one, Pat?
Honestly, please.
Honestly. We spend a lot of time in the development phase, as we've referred to, and then we've always found that the best thing to do is to have one bill of materials, so one parts list, and make lots of those bits and test lots of them, both in the factory and at the test track, so in Jerez and the 8 days of Bahrain testing. We endeavoured to have exactly the same power unit spec across all four cars, which gives us more data points, which just helps with our statistics on knowing how durable it is. And then we are fortunate that through the V8 period, we did a huge amount of learning on what introduces variability on the performance of the engine. So when we were in that freeze period, how did we do our development? We narrowed the gap between best and worst. We used to have a 1 to 2% difference across 10 engines, and we narrowed that down to 0.1, 0.2 of a percent. And the natural characteristics of the turbocharged engine are that that gap's narrowed even further, because there isn't so much performance from the tuning of the engine, which can be upset by small little changes in shape and coking up. So actually the spread across the engines when we pass them off is even narrower than it was on the V8, which means that we take the same parts list and we just adjust it for wiring, hoses, so just the small installation changes, and that determines whether it's a Silver Arrows engine or a Williams engine or a Force India engine or a McLaren engine. And then operating at the circuit, yes, we do development first with the works team. But then we pass it on once we've done that development period and we believe it's safe to hand on without needing an army of engineers to look after it. And the only other difference is the fuel types. McLaren run with ExxonMobil product. Other than that, they're identical. And as you can see at the weekend, Williams, the customer, was on the front row of the grid, and it was a tough fight all the way through.
If I could just jump in here, obviously McLaren is going to use Honda powertrains next year. Does your relationship with them this year change at all because of that decision?
No, we're you know, it's been a long, long period. The relationship between Mercedes and McLaren, and we've enjoyed success together. We've enjoyed some, or endured some miserable times together. It's always miserable if you're not winning. But it's there are some great relationships, and there's a strong professionalism from both sides. So if we ask that things are looked after with a little bit more security, McLaren have obliged, and the information about our engine can be gleaned by all the manufacturers that we're racing with today, via GPS analysis and via photographs into the garage as we're changing bits of bodywork and so on, and they're plastered all over the internet. So, it provides McLaren with an advantage working with us this year in terms of perhaps setting some targets in terms of what is achievable in terms of volume and heat rejection and shaft power, but we're not going to stand still. And Honda, I guess, have got a disadvantage that they're coming in as in their first year when it's everybody else's second year. And we spoke about earlier about, you know, what are the improvements going to be from Renault, Ferrari and ourselves for next year. So it's a professional relationship. We trust in the confidentiality aspects and arrangements that are set up, and we're all just running our own race.
We got any more questions? Probably time for one more. If not, we will wrap it up. Oh, yeah, one right at the back. Hang on, we got a microphone coming to you.
Just one away from the engineering aspect of things. Just wondering how you think that F1 can engage more with its audience and the spectators, maybe through social media or just involving the spectators more.
Yeah, I think it, as has already been said, it needs to have a more open-minded outlook on new media. And I think that's one thing. Also, I think listening to what the fans say they want, but bearing in mind that when you try and introduce solutions that are artificial, such as sticking megaphone exhaust pipes on or putting skid blocks on the bottom of the car to make sparks, people see through that, and the reaction to both those things has been, I believe, more vitriolic than any changes to formula or anything like that. So I think you need to be careful in what you change, and you need to be looking at properly thought out solutions as well.
Mark, I must ask, what do you think about this tweeting and getting a boost in Formula E next year?
I'm appalled.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that we need to do, which something like this obviously is attempting to do, is actually help people understand how interesting a high performance engineering challenge like Formula One is. Yes, not everyone is going to get it from a technical aspect. A lot of people are going to watch Formula One because they want to see which celebrity walks on the grid before the race starts or who they speak to in the paddock. Me, not so much. But it's a way to help get people interested in engineering and see it's a vibrant and interesting career. And I think that's something that the teams do participate in, I think, with F1 in schools, and is something, obviously, there's two of the teams are supporting here, but it's something that we do need to do more to get people interested in engineering right from the start when they're in primary school. Who likes maths? Loads of children don't put their hands up. Well, who likes Formula One? They all put their hands up. The two things don't go together.
I think that's my conclusion actually done, so thank you for that, Kirsty. It's absolutely perfect. Thank you so much to all four of you, Kirsty, Andy, Pat and Mark. It's been absolutely enlightening for me. I'm sure it's been the same for you. So please put your hands together for our panel tonight.
Hey, I'm a frost! Hey, I'm a frost! Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.